Here is John S. Doyle with a look at what it says in this morning's newspapers.
Cyril McGuinness, the criminal who died during a police raid at his home in England last week, is the subject of the lead stories in the Irish Independent and the Irish Daily Star. In the Independent, Paul Williams reports that according to reliable sources, McGuinness recruited two Dublin-based criminals to carry out surveillance on the five directors of Quinn Industrial Holdings in the weeks leading up to the abduction and torture of Kevin Lunny. The Star says it had been thought that McGuinness, the prime suspect for ordering the attack on Mr. Lunny, died moments after police raided his house last Friday. But Michael O'Toole writes the paper has now learned that officers were in McGuinness's home for several minutes before he suddenly fell ill. The Irish Times' main story is that governance and spending practices in An Garda Síochána, the health service executive and other public agencies have been sharply criticised in a report published by the Public Accounts Committee. As Jennifer Bray writes, the report finds that the Garda budget is being ineffectively managed and a review of all financial controls should be undertaken. It has also made recommendations about changes to the force's overtime budget. The President makes the lead story for the Irish Examiner for comments he made during a wide-ranging address to an intergenerational conference on climate justice in Cork yesterday. Owen English reports that Michael D. Higgins has warned that we are at the precipice of a global ecological catastrophe and the window of opportunity to act is closing worryingly fast. The President also told climate crisis activists ranging in age from 18 to 80 that if they want to make a significant impact in the battle to save the planet and life on it, they will have to address the issue of power and face down powerful interests. The climate catastrophe in Venice is pictured on the front page of the Irish Daily Mirror, and on a two-page spread inside, there's a photograph of soldiers knee-high in water in St. Mark's Square. Venice is experiencing its second worst floods on record. This is the result of climate change, said the city's mayor. Cork City is Ireland's Venice, according to Victoria White in a column in The Examiner. Just like Venice, it is built on water, she says. This gives the city its special character, but makes it vulnerable to flooding, as Venice is. White says there is no time to waste in addressing Cork's acute vulnerability to the new floods of the climate change era. The Irish Sun and the Mirror lead with the case of a Cork man, Thomas Lynch, sentenced to prison for having put poison on the handle of his supervisor's car. The Irish Daily Mail reports on what it calls a scathing attack by a High Court judge on the Department of Education in the case of an 8-year-old boy with a history of violence who has been expelled from his school in April. The judge, Richard Humphreys, described the decision to allow the boy to return to school as radically unhinged from common sense. There are many tributes to the actor Neil Tobin on his death at the age of 89. He has left the stage for the last time, having cast a long shadow from the footlights over 6 decades in Irish show business, says The Independent in an editorial which describes the late actor as a Cork man who became the voice of Dublin. And there is much coverage from Washington, D.C. of the first day of televised public hearings in the impeachment inquiry into U.S. President Donald Trump. There are few actions as consequential as the impeachment of a president, said the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, as quoted in Suzanne Lynch's front page piece in The Times. Mr. Trump himself was too busy to watch the proceedings, according to a front page story in The Examiner. But, says the paper, even as he tried to suggest he was above the fray, the president tweeted or retweeted more than 24 times before 12 noon, laying out his grievances about the process playing out on the opposite end of Pennsylvania Avenue.
The health service executive have a plan to cope with hospital overcrowding this winter. It'll cost €26 million and comes as the number of ill people waiting in hospitals for a bed in a hospital has regularly exceeded 600 in recent weeks. They'll publish their plan today. Our health correspondent Fergal Bowers is with us. Morning, Fergal. Tell us more about what overcrowding levels have been like in recent weeks.
Well, high levels of overcrowding have been recorded in recent months, certainly. And on November 6th, according to the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation, 679 patients were waiting for admission to a bed. That's a particularly high figure. But indeed, the number of attendances at emergency departments is up, according to the HSC data. Now, there's no major influenza circulating yet, and the first cold snap of winter really only just arrived in the last 24 hours. It's mid-November, relatively early in the health season in terms of what we're talking about, and we have still to hit the peak winter for emergency department purposes. And also the winter period for health purposes really runs up to the end of March.
So what are the main elements of the plan?
Well, the HSC will publish this plan today for 2019-2020, and it's supported by a €26 million in extra funding previously announced in the budget. We're going to see extra beds, greater access to Fair Deal nursing home places. That's because the number of patients occupying acute beds who are ready to be discharged but can't be for various reasons, that's remained particularly high, over 600 for recent weeks, adding to pressures. So the HSC will be hoping that extra nursing home supports and extra hours will assist earlier discharge, more transitional beds so patients can go from acute hospital to a midway facility, maybe then on home, extra aids and appliances for patients to be able to stay at home, and some extra medical, nursing and therapy support, and having pharmacy and lab support staff on for more periods to try and reduce the time patients spend in emergency departments, and also frail intervention team, community team supports to help reduce particularly those over 75 who might be at risk of falls ending up in emergency departments.
Why has the plan been published earlier than last year, although arguably we are well into winter at this stage?
Well, look, the last year's plan was published on the 6th of December. There has been pressure from opposition parties to see the detail as soon as possible, given those rising overcrowding levels I mentioned earlier. And now, so this year, 9 winter action teams, each of those linked to the health regions and hospitals within their regions, they have produced individual plans to deal with particular needs and any hospitals they have in their regions facing high levels. We know what they are, Limerick, Cork, Galway in particular. And those plans have fed into the overall winter plan by the HC to be published today, which has also been submitted to the Department of Health.
How big an impact will the plan have?
Well, look, a lot of elements are obvious. Extra capacity, staff, will they be enough? Can't answer that at this point. Other factors you can't control are a very harsh and long winter and a major flu outbreak. But of course, having senior clinical decision-making staff, especially at weekends and in that crucial period of Christmas and the New Year period around to assist in early discharge, certainly should help. Although, of course, as you know, the medical and nursing union view will constantly point to an overall lack of staff and bed capacity as the central problem. This plan will be tested during the winter period ahead to see if it's any better than previous plans. Or will patients continue to face very tough conditions of overcrowding in hospitals that regularly feature top of the list?
Fergal, thank you. That's our health correspondent, Fergal Bowers.
The United States House of Representatives has begun public hearings that could lead to the impeachment of President Donald Trump. Members of Congress have been investigating contacts between Mr. Trump and Ukraine, specifically a phone call in which the US president asked his Ukrainian counterpart to do us a favor by investigating his political rival, Democrat Joe Biden. Mr. Trump has denied any impropriety and rejects suggestions that he withheld hundreds of millions of dollars in military aid to Ukraine to pressure President Zelensky into cooperating. The US ambassador to Ukraine, Bill Taylor, told the hearing yesterday that the American aid was vital to Ukraine's security, but should never be tied to internal US political considerations.
The security assistance we provide is crucial to Ukraine's defense and to the protection of the soldiers I met on the front line last week. It demonstrates to Ukrainians and Russians that we are Ukraine's reliable strategic partner. It is clearly in our national interest to deter further Russian aggression. And finally, as the committee is aware, I wrote that withholding security assistance in exchange for help with a domestic political campaign in the United States would be crazy. I believed that then, and I believe it now.
This was President Trump's reaction to the public hearings when asked about the proceedings by reporters after a meeting yesterday with President Erdogan of Turkey.
Are you talking about the witch hunt? Is that what you mean? Is that what you're talking about? I hear it's a joke. I haven't watched for 1 minute because I've been with the president, which is much more important as far as I'm concerned. This is a sham and shouldn't be allowed. It was a situation that was caused by people that shouldn't have allowed it to happen. I want to find out who is the whistleblower. And because the whistleblower gave a lot of very incorrect information, including my call with the president of Ukraine, which was a perfect call.
Well, we can talk now to Bob Schmuel, Emeritus Professor of American Studies at the University of Notre Dame. Very good morning to you, Bob, and thanks once again for taking our call on this.
Good morning, Brian.
It involves all of this, a complicated series of contacts between the Trump administration and Ukraine. There's a cast of characters involved, some of them well-known, some of them less so, some of them anonymous. But at the heart of this is a question. Did President Trump link aid, military aid, to Ukraine to, in some way, the Ukrainians getting the dirt on Joe Biden? Was there a quid pro quo? In what we heard yesterday from Bill Taylor, is the investigation any closer to establishing that quid pro quo?
Not very much so. Probably the most important revelation from the testimony yesterday was Ambassador Taylor's comment that an aide of his had overheard a call between Gordon Sondland, who is the U.S. ambassador to the EU, and President Trump. And this call took place on July the 26th, the day after the call between President Trump and the president of Ukraine. And at the end of it, the aide asked Sondland, what did Trump think of Ukraine? And the response was, quote, President Trump cares more about the investigations of Biden. Now, that is interesting, but a question that I had after I heard it was, why did it take so long for this aide to report this to Ambassador Taylor? And why are we finding out about it now? The other comment that people are making over here is, why on earth is an ambassador calling the President of the United States on a insecure cell phone to talk about matters between the United States and Ukraine, with the possibility of the Russians and others listening into that conversation?
Presumably more light might be shed on this if and when the aide comes forward, as I think it is suggested they will, to give their account of this. But what is the potential impact of these hearings taking place in public in this way? There's been an investigation underway in private for some time, leaks from that, but the fact that this now will all be seen by Americans on live television, if they choose to tune in, what do you think might be the effect of that?
It is dramatic, but I would argue that it's just another episode in the Trump reality show that we've been experiencing since he was inaugurated. And by that I mean that the views of Americans have hardened to such a degree that I'm not even sure that these public hearings are going to make that much difference. If I had to guess, and you're not asking me to guess, but I will anyway, I would say that the House of Representatives will probably impeach the president. I think the Senate will acquit him, and that means that an impeached incumbent president will run for re-election, and then the voters will decide what they think of him next November. And I think that train is out of the station. We're just waiting to get to our destination.
Well, as you remind us, this is all taking place as the U.S. heads into its next election season. And one imagines that many senators, including Democratic presidential hopefuls, will want to be campaigning and not to be tied up in Washington in what might be a lengthy impeachment process.
Yes, and the Washington Post is reporting this morning that Republican members of the Senate are considering dragging out the trial, which will occur there after the House makes its determination, if it is to impeach the president, We now have six U.S. senators who are running for the nomination on the Democratic side. They will be needed in the Capitol for the trial at exactly the time that they would want to be in Iowa and New Hampshire, in Iowa for the February 3rd caucus, in New Hampshire for the primary that takes place the following week. Mm-hmm. The Republicans, to get back at the Democrats for launching this impeachment investigation, might hold them in the Capitol for the trial so that they cannot be out there talking to the people and campaigning for votes.
Bob Schmuel, as ever, thank you for talking to us this morning.
There's been a sharp increase in the number of cases of illegal dumping in border areas. Tires, household contents, diesel sludge and building rubble are all discarded on road verges and in beauty spots on a weekly basis. The cost of clean-up operations runs into thousands. Our reporter Eilish Sheehy travelled to both sides of the border where two councils are working together on a cross-border initiative.
We're in the Coody Mountains on the mountain road, and you can see rather beautiful scenic area. But unfortunately, the other side of it is that we have a very blighted view here because of illegal dumping and fly tipping. And we have a problem here in the North County with 23 areas that we have identified where there's constant fly tipping. In 2016, we would have been dealing with around 2,300 tonnes. Last year, 2,700 tonnes, and we're heading for 3,000 tonnes of illegally dumped rubbish in Louth County area.
This scene is becoming all too familiar for Catherine Duff. Her role as Director of Environment Services with Louth County Council takes her to locations all around the county where fly tipping has become the norm. In a bid to catch the culprits, the local authority has installed overt and covert cameras, proving to be very successful.
What we see is people quite blatantly during daylight hours coming to a remote location like this and removing sofas, couches, tyres, construction and demolition material, blatantly dumping it in the actual area. We have identified quite a number of individuals as a result, and this will be now progressed through the legal process.
Illegal dumping throughout the county is on the rise, but it's not just confined to Louth. Just over the border in County Down, the local authority there is also struggling to contain the problem. Now, for the first time, both councils are working together on a cross-border initiative.
We recently met with the Joint Council under our Memorandum of Understanding, and our elected members gave us the support to do a joint action plan with Newry and Mourne.
Local volunteers often take to the roads to clean up the mess left by others. Pat McCourt has been a member of the Omeath Tidy Towns Committee for the last 10 years. He thinks more local authority staff should be assigned to deal with the issues on the ground.
Well, we're here at Nara Water, where you're looking across to County Down. Well, this is a little slipway where they used to take cattle across years and years ago in little rowboats. And they do the business between Omeath and Warren Pint.
It's very scenic, Pat, isn't it?
It's such a beautiful area. And later on, we're hoping that the Greenway is going to come down this far and take us on into Newry from here.
But there's one problem.
People fly dumping. They actually burn stuff here on the top of the slipway at times. So there's bags here that someone has actually just dumped out, and parts of bottles and cans and tires. We've seen everything you can think of out of a whole household completely. Walls that was pulled down, just dumped down here where we're standing at the moment. Also the Tidy Towns, we got skips down, we took it all away.
I suppose it can be disheartening.
We think we're hitting a stone wall, that we're getting nowhere. It's getting worse year by year. And it's not only locals that are doing it, they're coming from Northern Ireland in to do it. There's no end to it.
Are the council doing enough?
Well, they say they are. They say they haven't got the revenue to do anymore, so we're not here knocking anyone down. We're just trying to pull together to see can we make it a better place for everyone to live in. You need more council people on the roads on a more regular basis. You have them all right, but they're doing too big an area.
It's the same story over the border in County Down. The Omeath to Newry Road is just one area of concern. Newry, Mourne and Down District Council spend around £100,000 annually dealing with illegal dumping. Roland Moore is the Director of Neighbourhood Services.
We would have a specific areas which on both sides of the border seem to be targeted for illicit dumping. It does cost a lot of money. We believe some of the problems are large scale, possibly even criminal activity. So there could be tires, there could be the remnants of diesel laundering. But we're also looking at the smaller scale, if you like, illicit dumping as well. So black bags full of rubbish and other household goods which are discarded at the side of the road or in ditches or in areas which they shouldn't be.
CCTV has been an important tool for Louth County Council. Not only has it helped identify the culprits, but also prosecute them. While Newry, Mourne and Down District Council doesn't have the facility in place, it is working on installing a similar system.
It's something that we're looking to do, particularly with our colleagues in Louth. It's one of the sort of key strands that we want to look at. There's a lot of technology out there we can use in terms of the mapping of hotspots on both sides of the border to see if we can identify patterns, and then using other technology such as CCTV overt use to try and catch people. We would spend hundreds of thousands of pounds over the last number of years on clean-up operations. We do need to do more. We believe the project that we're looking at with our colleagues in Louth can help assist with that.
Roland Moore from Newry, Mourne and Down and District Council, ending that report by Ailish Sheehy.
KBC Bank Ireland has reported a net profit of €4.4 million after taxes and impairments for the July to September period. That figure was affected by an €18 million charge relating to the central bank's tracker mortgage examination, with KBC setting aside €14 million for a potential fine. During the period, the bank saw customer numbers increase and its impaired loans reduce. Its parent company, KBC Group, also announced quarterly results this morning, reporting a profit of €612 million. We've also gotten quarterly results from AIR this morning, with the communications company earnings before interest, tax, depreciation and amortisation rising 2% to €140 million. That comes despite a 3% or €8 million fall in revenue, something that was more than made up for by an 11% or €12 million reduction in costs. Meanwhile, Disney says it signed 10 million customers up to its new streaming service in its first day of operation. Disney Plus launched in North America and the Netherlands on Tuesday, though it's not due to arrive in Ireland until the end of March next year. Finally, for now, look at the currencies. €1 buying you 85.7 pence sterling and $1.10.
23 minutes to 8, and we're joined by Des Cal. Morning, Des.
Good morning to you, Brian. Well, Mick McCarthy has named an experimental Irish team for tonight's friendly game against New Zealand. The manager said he won't start anyone who's set to play against Denmark in the crucial European qualifier next Monday. So Burton Albion goalkeeper Kieran O'Hara gets the nod in goal ahead of Mark Travers from Bournemouth. A new look back four sees Leo Connor from Celtic make his debut at right back. Derek Williams is on the left and Kieran Clark and Kevin Long in the middle. Preston's Alan Brown will play in midfield alongside Josh Cullen and Shamrock Rovers' Jack Byrne, while Shawnee Maguire and Robbie Brady will start either side of Troy Parrott in the attack. Now, on the face of it, you'd have to say this is New Zealand are not strong. They've never played Ireland before, and they haven't had much preparation. They haven't played for 18 months, and they've had just 2 days training. Up front, they have Burnley striker Chris Wood. There's a bit of an injury doubt about him. Their captain will be the West Ham defender Winston Reid, who's just coming back from missing 18 months through injury. But New Zealand's manager Danny Hay, who'll be having his first game in charge, says that despite the injury absence, Reid brings a lot to the New Zealand team.
As you know, he's taken that responsibility on numerous occasions before when he's been fit and available. So he holds a huge amount of respect and mana amongst the group. And I just look at the way the young players respond to his sheer presence in the environment, and it's massive. It's a big, big, big plus. You know, as when you're a player in that sort of position, you probably don't sense it. But as a coach, I can see it with the younger players. They respond really well around him. So he's very much a natural choice. But we have got, as you know, a number of other players that hold really good leadership qualities like Chris, Michael Boxall, Tommy Smith. There's some good experienced players that obviously can support Winston.
And that game is live on RT2. We'll have full commentary on Radio 1 Extra from 7:40 with Adrian Eames, Kenny Cunningham and Alan Colley. Radio 1 Extra is on the RT Radio Player app and on the RT website. Meanwhile, Ireland's under-21 side face Armenia in the European Championship qualifier. Kickoff is at 12 noon local time there, or 12 noon our time, 4 p.m. local time. At Wembley, England need just a point from their game tonight with Montenegro to qualify for Euro 2020. Although Raheem Sterling is dropped for tonight's game after a clash in the hotel with teammate Joe Gomez, England manager Gareth Southgate says he'll have no hesitation in selecting Sterling for Sunday's qualifier in Kosovo. St. Patrick's Athletic have signed midfielder Robbie Benson. The 27-year-old spent the past four seasons with Dundalk and will link up once more with former teammate Stephen O'Donnell, who's now the St. Pat's manager. Derry sprinter Jason Smith is today celebrating yet another world title after taking gold in the T13 100 metres at the World Para Athletics Championships in Dubai. He crossed the line in a championship record time of 10.54 seconds to clinch his fifth world title over the distance. Kerry's Jordan Lee was seventh in the high jump final. In the Northern Ireland Snooker Championship, there were wins for Fergal O'Brien, Mark Allen and Ken Doherty. O'Brien winning the last two frames to beat Jimmy Robertson 4-3. Mark Allen beat Jamie O'Neill 4-0. And Doherty had a 4-0 victory over Sahil Vahidi. Finally for now, racing news, and the Willie Mullins train Duvan returns to the racecourse today after a year and a half absence. The 8-time Grade 1 winner is one of 5 horses declared for the Clonmel Oil Chase, and the first race at Clonmel is off at 12:40.
Today is World Prematurity Day. That's an occasion to celebrate babies that were born early and survived. Prematurity is when a baby is born before 37 weeks of pregnancy. Europe's busiest maternity hospital, the Rotunda in Dublin, is marking the day with a party for 70 people who were born early and their families, and we'll be talking to the hospital's master shortly. But first, our reporter Jill Steadman has visited the neonatal unit at the Rotunda, where she met Nicola Mullen from County Wexford. Nicola gave birth to twin girls, Maya and Macy, just 10 weeks ago at 24 weeks. Sadly, Macy, who had anencephaly, died shortly after birth. Nicola spoke to Jill about the care that Maya is receiving.
Well, Mia was born 15 weeks early, so far we've been here 10 weeks. We still have probably another 5 to go, maybe longer. Like, everything they go through, all the needles, the surgeries, everything, like, you just know nothing will ever prepare you for seeing a baby that small going through everything that she has, you know, like, it's so heartbreaking. At the start, her lungs were very, like, immature, so she was on the ventilator, which she was on for a really long while. When she was about 4 weeks old, she had to go to Our Lady's Hospital in Crumlin to have a duct closed on her heart, and that was very, very scary, but she came through it, and after, I think it was about 2 weeks after her procedure, she was able to come off the ventilator, and she's on CPAP now, which is really good because she's only on like a little bit of oxygen, so it's just like a little bit of extra help. It's hard kind of like traveling up every day. We live in Wexford now, so we travel up every day to see Mia, but we have another baby at home who's 20 months old, so we're trying to divide our time, which is also very hard. But hopefully she'll be home soon, and this will just be like a distant memory then.
And tell us about some of the challenges. You mentioned travelling from Wexford. What other challenges have you faced?
When she was first on the ventilator, you weren't able to get to hold her a lot, and her skin was very delicate when she was first born. So trying to bond with her was really hard in the first few weeks. But now it's just amazing getting to hold her and just see her change every day. Like, it's brilliant.
Yourself and Aaron seem to be coping quite well now. You have a good support network. Is that very important?
Oh, definitely. I don't know how we would have coped without my family and Aaron's family and friends, and everyone here has been amazing as well. Do you know, like, they're very good at explaining stuff to you when you need them to, and they've just, everyone's just been amazing, really. Like, I don't know how we would have done it without them.
Nicola, you were showing me some photos of Mia. One of them stood out. Will you tell us a little bit about that photo?
Okay, so basically it's Mia in her little superhero cape, and they have a group of Rotunda knitters who send around packs all the time. Actually, they have lovely blankets, little booties, cardigans and all, but obviously on Halloween they had little costumes, which was so cute to see when we came in with Mia in our costume. They're so nice. Every time you come in, I think once a month or something, there's new packs like for us with blankets and stuff, and they're just adorable, like little tiny hats and all. Like,
And looking back on the photos, you can really see how much Mia has come on.
Yeah, she's grown so much, like from 1 pound 3 now to like 4 pounds. She is like such a big girl now. At the start, like it was hard to see her coming home. Now we feel like we're able to plan for her coming home and stuff. Now we wouldn't have an exact date in your mind. You wouldn't want to get excited hoping that she's getting out on her due date, but we can see her coming home. But it would be so nice to have her home for Christmas. That's what everyone's praying for.
That's Nicola Mullen, mother of baby Mia, talking to Jill Steadman. The master of the Rotunda Hospital is Professor Fergal Malone. He's with us in our studio now. Fergal, thank you very much for coming into us this morning. Tell us about the type of care that premature babies require.
Premature babies need the highest possible level of medical care. They need one-on-one nursing support throughout their stay, and they need high-level medical care from experts in neonatology. There's significant risk of infection for premature babies, there's significant risk for immature lungs, significant risk of bleeding in the brain. So it really is the highest possible level of care to protect our future citizens.
Why are babies born prematurely?
In many cases, we don't know. A woman comes in with preterm labour or rupture of the membranes and she just delivers. But for those, there are certain women who we know are at higher risk. For example, women who've previously had a preterm birth, women who are pregnant with twins or higher order multiple gestations, or if you have a medical complication like high blood pressure or diabetes.
Only 10% of babies born at 23 weeks survive, including one at your own hospital last year. But 70% of babies born at 24 weeks survive. Why such a big difference in the space of only a week?
So 23 to 24 weeks is what we call periviability. It really is at the margins of survival, and really small changes make a difference. A lot of it will depend on exactly how big that individual 23 or 24-week baby is and how strong they are, or what was the specific reason why they delivered. So for example, if a baby is born at 24 weeks because it's poorly growing and the mother had high blood pressure, that baby has less chance of survival than if the woman just went into labour with an otherwise healthy pregnancy.
The complications of being born early, do they persist into these babies' lives later?
Well, they certainly can do. Preterm birth and the complications of being born early are one of the most important causes of childhood morbidity. So, for example, preterm babies may have blindness. Preterm babies may have bleeding in the brain that can lead to cerebral palsy. But thankfully, the vast majority of babies born after 28 weeks will survive healthy with no long-term complications.
I mentioned at the start that the Rotunda is the busiest hospital in Europe. It's also very overcrowded. You went on Lifeline to talk recently about overcrowding after a dad went onto the programme to talk about changing his wife's sheets at the hospital after her fourth baby was born because staff were so busy. And you're quoted in this morning's Irish Times saying that overcrowding has led to the death of one baby and others suffering from meningitis.
So we know that there's a direct correlation between overcrowding, in particular in the neonatal intensive care unit, and infection control. If intensive care incubators are less than a metre apart, no matter how good the hand hygiene and infection control practices are in the hospital, it's almost impossible to prevent infection. The Rotunda has been lauded by HICWA for its hygiene standards, but there's nothing you can do about that if cots are so cramped together that you can't isolate and separate babies. So you need a minimum of 3 metres apart between incubators to provide safe care.
The long-term plan is to move the Rotunda to Blanchardstown, where you'll have an awful lot more space, and that was announced by the then Minister for Health, Leo Varadkar, in 2015. Where is that plan at now?
So while meetings have occurred to try and spec out exactly what the new Rotunda would look like on Connolly, there's been no meaningful advance in terms of actual development on the ground. The Rotunda put forward about 3 years ago a design plan for what the new Rotunda would look like on Connolly, but unfortunately Connolly as a hospital level doesn't have all of the critical care and intensive care facilities to receive Rotunda patients. So at the moment, if the Rotunda moved to Connolly tomorrow, we'd still actually have to move or transport our critically ill mothers back back into the matter if they got sick, because Connolly just doesn't have that sort of clinical infrastructure.
In the meantime, you want to expand at Parnell Square, yes?
In the meantime, I need to look after the patients we have today and for the next 10 years. In the next 10 years, Gavin, we will deliver over 90,000 women in Parnell Square on the Rotunda campus. That's an awful lot of clinical risk. So I do need to think about what is a safe way and the dignified way to care of those women. And that requires an infrastructure development on Parnell Square. And that can move ahead in parallel with plans for Connolly, but it is absolutely needed for today's safe care.
What's going to happen today at the hospital? Essentially a party to celebrate those who survived, yes?
This is a superb day in the calendar of the Rotunda. This is the graduation party for so many healthy survivors from prematurity. These are parents who have given their all to see their babies get through a very, very tough journey. And while a small number of our babies tragically don't make it, so many do, and so many do with healthy babies. And to celebrate that and to celebrate the contribution that these parents have made to the survival of their babies, a healthy survival of their babies, we throw a party every year on this World Prematurity Day.
Fergal Malone, Professor Fergal Malone, Master at the Rotunda Hospital, thank you very much for coming into us this morning. It's almost 10 to 8.
Now, 8:30 here on Morning Ireland, time for our business news with Adam Maguire. Adam.
Thanks, Brian. Well, it's probably too early for me to utter the C word, but the reality is that festive shopping is already well underway for many people. And year after year, more of that is being done online as choice and convenience increasingly trumps what's nearby. The problem for Irish retailers is that many of them aren't trading online, meaning that much of that money is going to multinationals like Amazon and ASOS. The IADOR, which manages the .ie web address, has undertaken a survey to gauge SMEs' online readiness. Its CEO, David Curtin, joins me in studio now to discuss this. David, retailers failing to get online isn't really new, but are they at least getting better?
Yes, Adam, this research of 1,000 SMEs is showing that, in fact, they are getting better. If we look at the number now that are able to process payments online, the number that are able to take sales orders online, there's a couple of percentage points increases compared to this time last year when we did the survey. So we now see that 32% can process payments online and 37% can take online bookings. So that's still low, but at least the trend is upwards.
The problem maybe, though, is that for those who still aren't at the races, the gap is getting bigger between what they're not offering and what is available online.
Well, that's the problem. You mentioned the spend that's going to the international retailers, whether it's Amazon or Alibaba. And it's really as Irish consumers drift away to those platforms that have ease of use and accessibility and so on, it's meeting their expectations. You know, and our survey would say that 53% of Irish consumers, they want their local high street shops to offer that full online shopping experience. And to be honest, they're not getting it from Irish SMEs. So as they drift away, the danger is they could stay away and it'll be harder for the SMEs then to win them back when they do put their e-commerce platform in place.
Is it not a bit unrealistic to expect an SME or small Irish retailer to compete with the likes of Amazon and the infrastructure and the money that company has?
Absolutely, you're 100% right. And our survey shows that there's a kind of a FUD factor with SMEs. It's that fear, uncertainty, doubt about digitizing their sales presence. So yes, they can compete in terms of the platform, but there's a lot of things that they can do. And we urge SMEs to start small. So consumers would like a click and collect service. You know, that's an online service. And it doesn't involve the whole platform that you'd need for an Amazon. So there's lots of small steps. So you can digitize, you can market more online, you can use social media, and we're seeing that as a trend as well. SMEs are using both the social media platform like Facebook in conjunction with the website, and the two together become powerful. And that's where they can compete with the big multinationals.
Many SMEs just don't bother with the website. They have a presence on Facebook or Twitter and they feel, well, that's good enough. I'm directly connecting with customers and I'm able to communicate them with on their platform. So why would I need a website in addition?
That's a good point. And we say, look, it's about the total integrated offering that you do digitally. So by all means, start on Facebook, attract the consumers, to your Facebook presence, but also then direct them to your website where you might have more information on your products and services, and you can have a better customer experience, I suppose, with a better website. So the two need to work together, and our survey is showing that that is the case, in fact, because when we look at usage of digital assets, the Facebook platform has increased slightly, Twitter has decreased, and the number of websites then as well is well up there in the high 70%.
David Curtin, CEO of the Irish Domain Registry, thank you very much for that. More business news in the next hour. For now, though, it's back to you, Gavin.
Let's get a weather forecast on this cold, wet morning. Joan Blackburn is at Metair. Morning, Joan.
Good morning, Gavin. Well, it's going to stay cold through the rest of this week and into early next week, with frost likely most nights. However, overall, it is going to be drier than recent days. Now, a blustery northerly wind set in overnight, which prevented a widespread frost, but we did get some, and the remaining frost and icy patches, mainly in parts of Connacht and Ulster, will clear. The day will be bright. There'll be some sunny spells. It'll be dry in many areas, but we will continue to have rain and hail showers feeding into parts of the northwest, north and eastern counties. These showers are likely to be a bit more wintry on the hills and mountains. The highest temperatures this afternoon, 5 to 8 degrees, and it will feel cold in that fresh and very blustery northerly wind. Mostly dry, clear and cold then tonight, but a few rain or hail showers will continue near exposed coasts. Overnight lows of plus 2 to minus 2 degrees, with some frost and icy patches in places. That frost will clear tomorrow morning to give us a cold, bright and mostly dry day for most areas, with sunny spells, but there will be a few rain or hail showers once again along parts of the east coast, but probably not as many as today, and eastern areas may well be cloudy. Afternoon highs of 6 to 8 degrees, but northerly winds will be a good deal lighter than today. A hard frost is expected tomorrow night, and some fog developing as well, in overnight lows of 0 to minus 3 degrees. And now the outlook. The frost will clear on Saturday morning, but fog may linger in places into the afternoon. Thickening cloud will bring rain into western counties, but the eastern half of the country is likely to hold dry, if rather cloudy. Afternoon highs of 4 to 8 degrees, and we will see frost in some eastern areas on Saturday night, but there'll be rain at times for the west. Then cold, with some scattered outbreaks of rain early on Sunday, giving way to drier and brighter conditions for the afternoon. Highs on Sunday of 6 to 8 degrees in moderate northerly breezes. Frosty on Sunday night with patchy mist and fog as well. And the cold conditions are expected to persist through Monday and Tuesday. It looks like being bright and dry for many places on Monday, but a few showers possible near eastern coasts. Frosty early on Monday night, but then cloud and rain will move in off the Atlantic overnight and for Tuesday morning. Finally today in brief, some frost at first in parts of Connacht, Ulster. A breezy, bright and dry day for many areas, but there'll be further rain or hail showers at times affecting parts of the northwest, north and eastern counties. Afternoon highs of 5 to 8 degrees in a blustery northerly wind. That's all from Met Éireann. Good morning.
It's 8 o'clock. Good morning again on Thursday the 14th of November. This is Morning Ireland on RTE Radio 1 with Brian Dobson and Gavin Jennings. The news is read by Brian Jennings.
The Health Service Executive will publish its winter plan today to try and alleviate overcrowding levels in hospitals until the end of next March. The plan aims to ensure timely hospital discharge and reduce congestion in emergency departments over the winter period. Our health correspondent Fergal Bowers.
High levels of overcrowding have been reported in recent months, and the true winter period has yet to be faced. Earlier this month, 679 patients were reported as waiting admission to a bed on one day by the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation. Today, the HSE will publish its winter plan, backed by €26 million in funding previously announced. It will see extra beds, greater access to Fair Deal nursing home places and more home care. Some extra medical nursing and therapy support is also promised. There will also be more senior clinical decision-making at weekends to assist with earlier discharge. Nine health regions have developed their individual plans, and these have fed into the overall plan, which has been submitted to the Department of Health.
A report due to be published today calls for a national family homeless strategy with the fundamental focus on children. The study on the impact of homelessness on children was carried out by the Oireachtas Committee on Children and Youth Affairs. Aisling Kenny reports.
The committee's report says the best interests of the child must be taken into account by local authorities when providing homeless supports. It calls for an end to practices such as placing children in hotel and B&B accommodation. It says the government must commission an independent evaluation into the suitability of family hubs. The committee also recommends a number of reforms to improve the well-being of homeless children. These include further supports for schools and the provision of year-round LEAP cards for children who are homeless.
US President Donald Trump has said he can't recall a phone call at the centre of revelations from the first public hearings of his impeachment inquiry. Giving evidence, the US envoy in Ukraine, Bill Taylor, said another diplomat was heard telling Mr. Trump on the phone that the Ukrainian government was ready to investigate the president's rival, Joe Biden. Mr. Taylor said it was clear the White House was refusing to release military aid to Ukraine until the probe began. At a news conference, Mr. Trump was asked about the overheard phone call with the US ambassador to the EU, Gordon Sondland.
I know nothing about that. First time I've heard it. The one thing I've seen that Sondland said was that he did speak to me for a brief moment, and I said no quid pro quo under any circumstances, and that's true. The other, I've never heard this. In any event, it's more second-hand information, but I've never heard it.
Gardaí have arrested two men and a woman and have been arrested as part of an investigation into the abduction and attack on Quinn Industrial Holdings director Kevin Lunny. This report just in from our northeast correspondent Sinead Hussey.
Gardaí say two men and one woman have been arrested as part of this investigation. They're being held this morning at Kells, Cavan and Monaghan Garda stations. Kevin Lunny was attacked on September 17th as he made his way home from work. Last week, the chief suspect in the investigation, Cyril McGuinness, died during a police raid in the UK. Other searches were carried out in Cavan, Longford and Dublin. Last week, Gardaí and the PSNI formed a joint investigation team to investigate the attacks on Quinn Industrial Holdings directors. Sinead Hussey, RTÉ News, Cavan.
Gardaí are investigating a series of attacks on sex workers in Dublin and the West over the past 4 weeks. Seven such attacks have occurred and thousands of euro have been stolen from both female and male escorts. Officers from the Garda National Protective Services Bureau say their investigations are at an advanced stage and they are appealing to other victims of the crime that have not yet reported it to contact them. Our crime correspondent, Paul Reynolds.
Gardaí say these attacks began in the middle of October and have followed a similar pattern. An online appointment was made with a sex worker, but when the so-called client arrived, the worker was attacked and robbed by a number of men. The victims, who were both male and female, were threatened, violence was used, and they were robbed of thousands of euro in cash. In one case, two people were attacked and robbed in the same apartment. Six of the attacks have occurred in Dublin, the other in the West. Gardaí believe the attacks are connected and say their investigations are at an advanced stage. The Garda National Protective Services Bureau says it's working closely with the victims and treating them with the utmost sensitivity and confidentiality. They also suspect there may be other victims who have not yet come forward, and they're appealing to sex workers who have been attacked but have not yet reported the crime to contact them.
Fine Gael's National Executive Council will meet in Dublin this evening to consider whether to remove Deputy Maria Bailey from the party's general election ticket in Dunleary. It follows a demand for an urgent review by a majority of Fine Gael members in the four-seat constituency last month. Deputy Bailey has been in political difficulty since it emerged that she'd taken a personal injuries claim against a Dublin hotel after falling off a swing. She later withdrew the claim. Our political correspondent, Paul Cunningham.
Fine Gael's Executive Council, which is drawn from Oireachtas members, councillors, ordinary members and officers, will gather at the party's Mount Street headquarters in Dublin. The standout item on the agenda is a motion from its Dunleary branch calling for an urgent review of the constituency's general election candidates. While Deputy Bailey isn't mentioned in the motion by name, the clear intent was to have her removed. It's expected that the Executive Council will be given a recommendation from the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar on how they should proceed with the matter. There is a widespread belief within Fine Gael that the Council will be swayed by the membership in Dunleary and will vote to remove Deputy Bailey's candidacy.
Now the time is coming up to 7 minutes past 8.
RTE Radio 1 weather with ESB Networks. Working on a construction site? Stay clear of overhead wires and underground cables. For emergencies, call 1850 372 999.
Frost and icy stretches mostly in parts of Connacht, Ulster and North Leinster, clearing this morning to give a cold, bright day with good sunny periods. Many places will be dry, but scattered rain or hail showers will affect northern and northwestern and some eastern counties. Highest temperatures 5 to 8 degrees in a blustery northerly wind. There's a warning that north to northeast winds will reach gale force for a time this morning on Irish coastal waters from Wicklow Head to Roaches Point to Valentia and on the South Irish Sea.
John S. Doyle is here again with It Says in the Papers.
Cyril McGuinness, the criminal who died during a police raid at his home in England last week, is the lead story for the Irish Independent and the Irish Daily Star. In the Independent, Paul Williams reports that according to reliable sources, McGuinness recruited two Dublin-based criminals to carry out surveillance on the five directors of Quinn Industrial Holdings in the weeks leading up to the abduction and torture of Kevin Lunny. The Star says it had been thought that McGuinness, the prime suspect for ordering the attack on Mr. Lunny, died moments after police raided his house last Friday. But, Michael O'Toole writes, the paper has now learned that officers were in McGuinness's home for several minutes before he suddenly fell ill. The Irish Times' main story is that governance and spending practices in An Garda Síochána, the Health Service Executive and other public agencies have been sharply criticised in a report published by the Public Accounts Committee. As Jennifer Bray writes, the report finds that the Garda budget is being ineffectively managed and a review of all financial controls should be undertaken. It has also made recommendations about changes to the force's overtime budget. The President is the lead story for the Irish Examiner for comments he made during a wide-ranging address to an intergenerational conference on climate justice in Cork yesterday. Owen English reports that Michael D. Higgins has warned that we are at the precipice of a global ecological catastrophe and the window of opportunity to act is closing worryingly fast. The President also told climate crisis activists ranging in age from 18 to 80 that if they want to make a significant impact in the battle to save the planet and life on it, they will have to address the issue of power and face down powerful interests. The climate catastrophe in Venice is pictured on the front page of the Irish Daily Mirror, and on a two-page spread inside, there's a photograph of soldiers knee-high in water in St. Mark's Square. Venice is experiencing its second worst floods on record. This is the result of climate change, said the city's mayor. The Irish Sun and the Mirror lead with the case of a Cork man, Thomas Lynch, sentenced to prison for having put poison on the handle of his supervisor's car. The Irish Daily Mail reports on what it calls a scathing attack by a High Court judge on the Department of Education in the case of an 8-year-old boy with a history of violence who had been expelled from his school in April. The judge, Richard Humphreys, described the decision to allow the boy to return to school as radically unhinged from common sense. The first day of televised public hearings in the impeachment inquiry into US President Donald Trump makes the front page of two papers, The Times and Examiner. Mr. Trump himself said he was too busy to watch the proceedings, The Examiner reports, but even as he tried to suggest he was above the fray, the president tweeted or retweeted more than 24 times before 12 noon, laying out his grievances about the process playing out on the opposite end of Pennsylvania Avenue, the paper says. There are many tributes to the actor Neil Tobin on his death at the age of 89. He has left the stage for the last time, having cast a long shadow from the footlights over six decades in Irish show business, says The Independent in an editorial. Noel Grealish, Independent Galway West TD and a former leader of the Progressive Democrats, is the subject of editorials in two other papers. This follows his question in the Doyle this week about whether money sent from Ireland to Nigeria over the last 8 years was the proceeds of crime and fraud. This hatred of the other cannot be tolerated, says the Examiner, because we all know only too well where it ends. Shame on you, Deputy Grealish, says the paper. By allying himself with local elements opposed to the establishment of a direct provision centre, and by questioning the law-abiding nature of Nigerian migrants, Mr. Grealish is treading dangerous ground, says the Times. We should remember our past, and politicians should tread very carefully.
John S. Doyle, thank you, John. After the break, those arrests in the Quinn investigation. 8:15 here on Morning Ireland. We go straight to the breaking news this morning of three arrests in connection with the investigation into the abduction and attack on Quinn Industrial Holdings director Kevin Lunny. We can talk to our northeast correspondent Sinead Hussey. Sinead, we know that the Gardaí and PSNI formed a joint investigation team to investigate this attack and other attacks on Quinn Industrial Holdings. We know there was that raid in the UK in which the chief suspect Cyril McGuinness collapsed and died. What can you tell us about this latest development?
Yes, Brian, this has been a very intense investigation, and we understand that there's been three arrests today, two men and a woman. Two are being held under Section 50 and another being held for withholding information. I understand they're being held at Cavan, at Kells and Monaghan, the stations. We saw, as you said last week, these searches take place in Cavan, Longford, Dublin and in the UK. We saw the PSNI and the Gardaí form that joint investigative team, and they're looking at all of the attacks on Quinn Industrial Holdings directors. It's almost 2 months now since Kevin Lunny was attacked as he made his way home to Derry Lynn. Last week, during that spotlight interview on BBC, we heard firsthand the violence, the extreme violence inflicted on him. And even since then, the Taoiseach has met with him and the other directors. So really, this is a very intense investigation. We expect further details on these arrests later, but certainly it's a significant development.
Very good. More from you, no doubt, Sinead, in the course of the day.
Next to old computer systems in government departments and the public service, 46,000 of the HSE's 58,000 laptops and desktops are operating an old software, and it has spent over €300,000 patching it up. That's because Microsoft will stop protecting Windows 7 from viruses and malware from January the 14th of next year, except for those who pay a new premium for extended security support. 22,000 computers in various government departments and offices also continue to run on the old Windows 7 system. Cian McCormack has the story. Cian, what's this about?
Well, Gavin, put simply, it's about old computers not being upgraded despite warnings that this needed to happen about 2 years ago. The first thing to know here is, what is Windows 7? It's the operating system, it's the software that makes a computer work. And as you were just saying earlier, Microsoft will stop protecting Windows 7 from January 14th of next year, 2020, except for those who pay for extended security support, and that extended support stops at the end of 2020. Now, this means if you basically have three options, you can get the new Windows 10 software, get a new computer, or pay Microsoft extra money to continue protecting your PC on Windows 7.
Now, the HSE has already footed a bill of hundreds of thousands of euros. Tell us about that.
The HSE has paid €330,000 for an extended warranty to protect 16,000 Windows 7 computers until June next year. But as we've been saying earlier, 46,000 of the HSE's 58,000 desktop and laptop computers remain on the Windows 7 operating system.
So it could cost more than €330,000.
Possibly, but the HSE told Morning Ireland in a statement that Microsoft offered the HSE extended security updates last Tuesday, but there was no financial proposal with that offer.
So what could it cost the HSE?
Well, the HSE says it's not in a position to comment on that because Microsoft pricing fees for extended support have not yet been released. However, there are agreements with other government departments. The Department of Public Expenditure is paying €48 per computer for extended warranties on 398 computers until the end of 2020 at a cost of about €20,000. The pricing structure, it hasn't been confirmed by Microsoft, but on that type of arrangement, industry and government sources say that it's about €50 per device for the first 12 months, then double that, or €100 for the next 12 months, and then double that again, €200 for the remaining 12 months. And this means an organisation with 1,000 PCs on Windows 7 could possibly face a fee of €50,000 in 2020, rising to €200,000 in 2022. But some organisations may get better pricing if they have a large number of Windows 7 computers.
Now, Cian, the issues are due to be raised in the Dáil.
Yeah, all this information was unearthed by Labour TD Alan Kelly through parliamentary questions to lots of government departments. Deputy Kelly plans to raise the issue in the Dáil and at the Health and Public Accounts Committees. He's deeply concerned.
HSE is the largest public sector organisation in the country. The fact that this changeover has to happen by the end of January, and here we are in mid-November, and there's that scale and amount of work to be done, amount of laptops and desktops to be migrated, it's not an exaggeration to say that this is going to cost a serious amount of money if they don't act very fast. Now, there are departments who answered my PQs who actually demonstrated that they had migrated their computer systems substantially and will have almost all of the work, if not all of the work, done. And they deserve to be complimented. But then again, there are other departments who have a mixed bag of results, where in some cases they haven't been able to migrate and they will be paying license fees. So there's no doubt that across departments and across agencies under each department, that the taxpayer is going to fork out unnecessarily because of the fact that these organisations and departments are going to have to pay for licences next year and possibly on to the following year as well. And that's crazy. Where you're running operating systems that are operating on patches, in inverted commas, and depending on licences that need to be upgraded for short-term periods, there is a capacity for viruses, there's a capacity for cyber attacks. So I'm deeply worried that in the HSE and in some government departments, we could have cyber attacks. We're leaving ourselves open to that. And the fact that at government level, they haven't been able to ensure that we could avert this is worrying. And it does show there hasn't been a cross-government thinking in relation to this.
Labour TD Alan Kelly there. The HSE in a statement said that the protection of personal data is a top priority and it uses layered security to protect data from hackers and malware. Also, it said it has an accelerated refresh program to address the Windows 7 issue and expects this work to be finished within the calendar year, with the exception of a number of devices. Also, some of its health systems don't run on Windows 10. It says it is continuously replacing and updating older systems. Costs are built into current budgets and future costs depend on priorities and available budgets.
Now, that's the HSC. Cian, you mentioned that other government departments, are they affected too?
Yes, Gavin. The Department of Justice has 3,700 computers operating on Windows 7. There are 2,950 in the Department of Agriculture, 11,010 in the Department of Employment Affairs and Social Protection. Initial figures dug out for Alan Kelly's parliamentary question show there are 22,312 computers across various government departments and offices running on Windows 7. But there has been a proactive drive to get everything up to date. Barry Lowry is the government's chief information officer at the Department of Public Expenditure. As a policy and strategy officer, he has a broad overview about what's happening at government level, and he feels there is enough security in place in departments and offices in government to protect systems and people's data.
I don't think any organisation should take cyber attacks lightly, but devices don't suddenly become unprotected in January 2020. You know, the option is there to take out Microsoft security support through 2020 and further if you need to. The IT departments within the various departments are carrying out refresh programs and also already have security programs in place. I'm pretty confident that technically we're in a pretty good position.
Deputy Kelly was also saying that at government level we haven't been able to avert this. It's worrying and shows there should have been a cross-government approach to this.
Yes, I can understand why I would say that, but obviously the position's much more complicated than that, because if you take a cross-government approach, you're actually comparing a PC in a policy department, which is only used for email and for writing documents using Microsoft Office, to perhaps a PC in a hospital, which is linked to a particularly niche but particularly important piece of medical equipment. It's impossible to say that over every month we're going to just do so many PCs because, as I said, it's much more complicated than that. And if you carry out your inquiries and you actually find out that the piece of medical equipment will not run under any circumstances with Windows 10, then you have to take other forms of mitigation.
That's Barry Lowry, the government's chief information officer there, ending that report by Cian McCormack.
An investigation is underway into a number of targeted attacks on sex workers, mainly in the Dublin area. Gardaí have said 7 attacks have taken place on sex workers advertising services on online sites since the middle of October. On each occasion, an online appointment is made, but when the parties involved meet, the sex worker is attacked and robbed by a number of men. Investigations into the attacks are described as being at an advanced stage. We can hear more now from Detective Chief Superintendent Declan Daly from the Garda National Protective Services Bureau. A very good morning to you, Chief Superintendent, and thank you for taking our call this morning.
No, thank you, Brian, and I appreciate the opportunity for allowing me to talk about these concerning incidents this morning.
Concerning indeed. What do you know at this stage about these attacks?
Okay, so we're investigating, as you said, we're investigating a series of robbery-motivated attacks on persons working in prostitution. Since the middle of October, 7 such attacks have taken place nationwide, as you said, mainly in the Dublin area, but they have been in other counties and cities. What's happened, as you explained, is that an online booking is made. However, when the purported client arrives, he and others assault the victim, and well, both male and female, and then a search is conducted of the premises, and cash and other valuable phones, etc., are taken.
So you're aware of 7 attacks, but presumably you might have some concern that there could have been more, but that the Correct. Victims have been reluctant to come forward.
Correct, and that's the reason for the appeal today. We're appealing for any persons who are working in this industry or who have information about these attacks to contact us via the local Garda station or via the confidential line of 1-800-666-111.
And how will they be treated? What will happen if they do come forward?
So obviously our primary concern here is the protection of people in our community. So they will be treated with sensitivity and compassion and confidentially.
And just to be clear, prostitution is not a crime unless you're involved in soliciting prostitute or involved in pimping and in organising prostitution.
Bottle keeping, yes. So since 2017, the sale of sex has been decriminalised, but the purchase of sex, though, the client now commits the offence.
So to be absolutely clear here, a sex worker who's assaulted comes forward to the Gardaí and speaks to you will not face prosecution. That simply doesn't arise.
That's not even a consideration for us. The consideration is the welfare and the harm and the danger that they're in at the moment.
Do you have advice to sex workers, given that your suspicion presumably is that these attacks are ongoing and are organised and systematic?
Yeah, I think they need to be very vigilant at the moment, particularly if they're taking online clients, if that's the medium through which these attacks are starting. So I think they need to be very vigilant in relation to that. And obviously, if they have concerns about a client, well, obviously, then they just vacate the appointment or cancel the appointment.
And are there precautions they can take?
Well, it's very difficult because this was the nature of the work is that it's difficult. Is that it people who they don't know. So, I mean, they can simply at the moment, and we're working very very diligently and quickly to resolve this issue. So they could, if they were of mind to forgo online appointments and maybe just to deal with people who they know from previous encounters.
Right. Clearly, they're very vulnerable. They're very isolated.
Correct.
And very exposed to this kind of attack.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. I mean, working in the prostitution industry are a lot of vulnerable people. There's a high element of exploitation in that industry, so we're very concerned, for the safety and welfare of these workers.
We'll leave it there. Detective Chief Superintendent Declan Daly, thank you for talking to us. After the break, we'll have news headlines. And let's take another check on the business headlines this morning. Here again is Adam Maguire. Adam.
Thanks, Brian. KBC Bank Ireland has reported a net profit of €4.4 million after taxes and impairments for the July to September period. That figure was affected by an €18 million charge relating to the central bank's tracker mortgage examination, with KBC setting aside €14 million for a potential fine. During the period, the bank did see customer numbers increase, however, and its impaired loans reduce.
Germany's economy expanded by 0.1% in the third quarter, narrowly avoiding the two consecutive quarters of decline that would represent a recession. As weak as the quarterly growth was, it was still ahead of economists' expectations, though it was made alongside a downward revision to GDP data for the previous 3 months. The poor data is being heavily influenced by a sluggish manufacturing sector, with output there falling 1.3% in September alone. Another major economy that's cooling is China, which has reported a slowdown in consumer spending and factory production. Chinese investment growth has hit a record low as the trade war with the US takes its toll. Finally, the currency markets, €1 buying you 85.8 pence sterling and $1 and 10.1 cent.
Des Cahill's here at the Sports News. Morning, Des.
Good morning to you, Gavin. We're starting with tonight's soccer international between Ireland and New Zealand. Mick McCarthy has named a weakened Irish team. He's not going to start anyone who's set to play against Denmark in the crucial European Championship qualifier next Monday. So, Burton Albion goalkeeper Kieran O'Hara starts in goal, although Mark Travers from Bournemouth will get some game time. The back four, Leo Connor of Celtic makes his debut at right back, Derek Williams of Blackburn on the left, and in the middle it's Kieran Clark alongside Kevin Long. Preston's Alan Brown is in midfield alongside Josh Cullen of West Ham and Shamrock Rovers' Jack Byrne. And up front, Seanie Maguire and Robbie Brady play either side of Troy Parrott. Now, on the face of it, you'd have to say this is not a strong New Zealand team. The New Zealand team hasn't played for 18 months.
Oh.
They've had just 2 days' training. And up front, they have Burnley striker Chris Wood, and there's an injury doubt about him. Their captain tonight will be the West Ham defender Winston Reid, but he's just coming back from missing a season and a half through injury as well. Let's hear from the Irish defender Kieran Clark, who has been absent also for a long time, but he's shown good form since getting back into the Newcastle United team.
Yeah, it's obviously great to be back. It was a tough end to the season last season and beginning to this one, but yeah, obviously everyone wants to be playing games, and for me personally it's great to be back now involved and playing, and yeah, obviously managed to get a couple of goals as well, which was nice.
I mean, Steve Bruce was speaking at the weekend saying how tough it is as a centre-half at Newcastle. There are six of you, most of you in pretty decent form. How difficult has it been having to remain patient and wait for your chance?
Yeah, I knew that was going to be the case from the start of the season, to be honest. Like I said, there's a lot of fit centre-backs there now, and everyone's fighting for a place in the team and the squad, so I think it's just about working hard day in, day out in training, and you know, waiting for that opportunity at a weekend, and yeah, thankfully I got mine, and I've managed to stay in the team since.
And your form has got you back in the Ireland squad. That's great after such a gap.
Yeah, definitely, it's been a while now, and yeah, I knew myself that unless I was playing games regularly, then I wasn't going to get a call, and you know, obviously my main aim was to try and get back into the Newcastle team and get a little run there and try and stay there, and you know, knowing that, then obviously with the back of my mind I'd know then that I might have a chance of, you know, getting into the squad here now, and which I managed to do. So yeah, I'm delighted with that, and yeah, looking forward to this trip.
And how tough has that been, because like Robbie Brady, you were part of the team that played against France there in Italy and what have you in the Euros, and then, you know, to find you're not in the squad, that must be quite difficult.
Yeah, it's hard, but I think that's just football, you know. If you're not playing games regularly, then it's hard to justify, you know, being picked. So yeah, it's frustrating and disappointing, but it gives you that motivation then, you know, to keep working hard day in, day out, and you know, trying to force yourself back into it at club level to then obviously to try and get into the squads.
That's Kieran Clark. Now, the game is live on RT2 television and with full live commentary on Radio 1 Extra from 7.40 tonight with Adrian Eames, Kenny Cunningham and Alan Cawley. Radio 1 Extra on the RT Radio Player app and the RT website. Now, Ireland's under-21s play Armenia in the European Championship qualifier today. That kicks off at 12 noon Irish time, 4 p.m. in Armenia. At Wembley, England need just a point from their game tonight with Montenegro to make sure of qualifying for Euro 2020. Although Raheem Sterling is dropped for tonight's game after a clash in the hotel with his teammate Joe Gomez, England manager Gareth Southgate says he will select Sterling for Sunday's qualifier in Kosovo. St Patrick's Athletic have signed midfielder Robbie Benson. The 27-year-old spent the last four seasons with Dundalk And we'll link up once more with former teammate Stephen O'Donnell, who's now the St. Pat's manager. In golf, Padraig Harrington level par after six holes of the Nedbank Challenge in South Africa. His playing partner, local hero Ernie Els, is in the leading group on 2 under. News from this morning's action at the World Para Athletics Championships in Dubai, and Ireland's Greta Strima-Kaito has finished fifth in the T13 1500 metres final in Dubai. The 2018 European champion, who was born in Lithuania but runs out of Clonliffe Harriers, posted a time of 4 minutes 48.75. Yesterday, of course, Derry sprinter Jason Smith celebrated another world title, taking gold in the T13 100 metres, crossing the line in a championship record time of 10.54 seconds for a fifth world title over the distance. Kerry's Jordan Lee was seventh in the high jump final. Now, elsewhere in the Northern Ireland Snooker Championship last night, there were wins for Mark Allen, Fergal O'Brien. Ken Doherty also through. Mark Allen beat Jamie O'Neill 4-0. O'Brien won the last two frames to beat Jimmy Robertson 4-3, and earlier Doherty had an easy 4-0 victory over Sahil Vahidi. Finally for now, racing news, and the Willie Mullins trained Duvan is set to return to the racecourse today after a year and a half absence. The 8-time Grade 1 winner is one of 5 horses declared for the Clonmel Oil Chase. After a lot of rain overnight, the going is now soft to heavy there, and the first race at Clonmel is at 12:40.
Ireland's EU Commissioner Phil Hogan has said that British consumers will expect the UK to sign up to the EU's labour, environmental and food standards as part of a free trade agreement for which he will be the chief negotiator next year. Giving an upbeat prediction of how quickly the trade negotiations could be concluded, Mr. Hogan, the EU Trade Commissioner designate, said the EU will be ready to go before St. Patrick's Day next year, but that the UK would have to decide early on in the process which EU rules it's prepared to sign up to. Phil Hogan was speaking to our Europe editor, Tony Connolly, in Brussels last night.
The United Kingdom are members of the European Union. They've been part of the trade framework for the last 45 years. So we're not starting from scratch. So they have to decide which regulations they want to stay in or to remove themselves from under the negotiations that would happen between the EU and the UK. But also in the document that was published on the future relationship, there are many policy issues already agreed, such as the level playing field in relation to environment and labour laws and standards, such as many of these issues could have been difficult were it not for the fact that they were included as part of the agreement under phase one. I would say the majority of the regulations that are there at the moment won't cause any difficulty for the consumers, our workers, or people involved in environmental or agriculture, if they want to have the highest possible standards. And I think that's the key issue, standards. And I think that the British public will demand and expect that their government will sign on to the European Union standards, because we're the highest standards in the world.
EU Commissioner Phil Hogan speaking there to Tony Connolly, who joins us now from Brussels. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning, Brian.
How significant is what Phil Hogan has been saying?
I think this is significant, Brian. He's obviously being quite circumspect because, first of all, he's only the Commissioner for Trade designate. He doesn't formally take up the role until the whole Commission is sworn in, and that hasn't happened yet. And obviously he doesn't want to interfere in the general election in the UK. But what he is saying is that the pressure for the UK post-Brexit to sign up to the EU's regulatory sphere or regulatory orbit, he thinks will come from British consumers. So rather than make this a political judgment by Boris Johnson, if he is elected as the new leader if the Conservative Party win the election, he's kind of saying that British consumers themselves would take up this issue, and that would mean it would be politically possible for Boris Johnson, wins the election, for him to follow that path. Now, of course, this flies in the face of what Boris Johnson has been saying and what Tory Eurosceptics have been saying, that post-Brexit they don't want anything really to do with the EU's regulatory sphere. They want to be completely arm's length, pursuing their own free trade agreements around the world. But here, Phil Hogan seems to be suggesting that because the UK has been part of the EU's regulatory framework for 45 years, then it shouldn't be that much of a stretch for the UK to maintain some kind of regulatory alignment, if mm-hmm. you like, with the EU. But of course, there's a lot of questions about how politically that possible yeah. that would be for Boris Johnson.
And also, it is something that would have to be negotiated. Presumably, it would be potentially a central issue in the negotiations. How much of an issue is it likely to be for both sides?
Well, there's a fundamental trade-off, Brian, between the access that you get to the single market and the extent to which, as a third country, you're prepared to be bound by the rules of that single market. And this has always been at the core of Brexit, the idea that Britain could leave the European Union but still have frictionless trade with the European single market has always been challenged by the EU, saying that you can't enjoy that kind of access unless you're prepared to sign up to EU rules and be subject to the enforcement procedures of the European Court of Justice and the monitoring of the European Commission and so on. Phil Hogan seems to be suggesting that the UK could perhaps decide early on in the process that they would be bound by certain regulations mm-hmm. In certain spheres and that there might be other spheres of regulations that they would want to be not part of.
Just finally, briefly, Tony, you also asked Phil Hogan about how confident he was that a deal could be concluded relatively quickly.
Yes, I mean, the question has been raised in the general election debate in the UK about how quickly a free trade agreement could be struck. And this is important because if the free trade agreement isn't ready by the end of next year, then the transition lapses and there is then a no deal situation. And Boris Johnson, if he's the new Prime Minister, will have to decide by July if he does want to extend the transition beyond the end of the year. But Phil Hogan, when I asked him, was suggesting that things could happen fairly quickly because the European Commission has already been doing quite a lot of preparation. Here's what he had to say.
I would say there'll be a significant amount of progress made because we'll be ready to go in the springtime. The Council have to give us a mandate. All of the various details around that can be achieved very quickly. We can get into negotiations before Patrick's Day if there is political goodwill on the part of the United Kingdom. And we're ready to go. And let's see how far we can get. But there's also provision in the agreement to extend by 6 months the transitional period if that's necessary. And I don't think that small period of time will be a problem for either side if we see that we're making substantial progress.
Phil Hogan, earlier you heard our correspondent Tony Connolly.
Last week, the US formally began the process of withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accord. President Donald Trump has in the past dismissed climate change as a hoax. But while there may be scepticism in the White House, growing numbers of climate change activists have been holding demonstrations across America. As part of RT's Week on Climate, our Washington correspondent Brian O'Donovan has been taking a look at the politics and protests of climate change in the US.
The climate, the environment, millions of people and species are being killed.
Every week, for the last 5 weeks, Hollywood actress Jane Fonda has been holding climate change protests in Washington. Since starting her weekly protests, Jane Fonda has been arrested 4 times.
Jane Fonda, can I ask you, what is your message to Donald Trump when it comes to climate change?
Get out of office.
Do you think
out of the way so that we can do the right thing?
So what are you hoping to achieve by your campaign?
We're hoping that people will mobilize by the millions to force whoever gets elected to do the right thing, to stop fossil fuel, new fossil fuel production, and to phase out already existing fossil fuel over 30 years and make sure that workers are paid good salaries.
Jane Fonda says she was inspired by teenage climate activist Greta Thunberg.
The people in power continue to ignore us.
Swedish teenager Greta Thunberg has been making waves here in the US ever since she arrived in New York by boat in August. She traveled by sea to cut down on her carbon footprint. She has been holding protests across America and addressed members of Congress on Capitol Hill. Republican Representative Garrett Graves asked her what was the point of it all if big polluters like China are refusing to play their part.
Here we are talking about reducing emissions, yet China, under the Paris Accords, are going to be increasing their emissions by nearly 50%.
I am from Sweden, it's a small country, and there it is the same argument. Why should we do anything? Just look at the US, they say. So just so you know, that is being used against you as well.
Greta Thunberg also delivered an emotional address at the United Nations.
You all come to us young people for hope. How dare you? You have stolen my dreams and my childhood with your empty words, and yet I'm one of the lucky ones. People are suffering. People are dying.
Tonight on the CBS Evening News, a new wildfire erupts near Los Angeles, forcing thousands to flee.
What looks like the first hurricane of the season in the U.S. is bearing down on the Gulf Coast.
Whether it's Atlantic storms and hurricanes or wildfires in California, extreme weather events across the U.S. are becoming more frequent. Professor Aradhana Tripathi is a climate scientist with the University of California.
Climate change is having a dramatic impact on the frequency of fires that we're seeing in California. The fact that we have fossil fuel emissions, it's driving warming, in turn is driving a rise in evaporation rates in the spring through autumn months. So that just means that the soil's drying out, plants are drying out. And this is happening to a more and more severe level. So now our fire season is actually much longer than it was before, because there's so much now of the year that's associated with really warm temperatures from the spring to even into the winter. We even have winter heat waves that are occurring here in California.
Thank you.
Despite big changes in U.S. weather, Donald Trump has, in the past, dismissed climate change as a hoax. When he was campaigning to become president, he vowed to pull America out of the Paris Climate Accord, and as soon as he was elected, he kept that promise.
The United States will withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord.
Last week, the U.S. formally began the process of withdrawing from the Paris Accord. The Trump administration says it places an unfair economic burden on America.
So we're getting out, but we will start to negotiate, and we will see if we can make a deal that's fair. And if we can, that's great. And if we can't, that's fine.
Where do we want it?
Green New Deal.
When do we want it?
Now.
America's withdrawal from the Paris Accord may not go ahead if Donald Trump loses the White House next year. Climate change will be a big issue as the election 2020 campaign gets into full swing.
Are you heartened by any of the other candidates out there that they will do a better job on climate change?
Anyone would do a better job.
That's Jane Fonda speaking to our Washington correspondent, Brian O'Donovan.
The National Women's Council is calling for quotas for women candidates already in force for Doyle elections to be extended to local authorities. The council is today publishing the results of a survey of local election candidates, which argues that women confront a number of barriers not faced by men. Orla O'Connor is director of the National Women's Council, and she's here with us in studio. Very good morning to you. Thank you for coming to talk to us. First of all, can you give us a picture of the situation at the moment when it comes to women in local government?
Yeah. So the report that we're launching today is a survey of women who were elected locally and their experiences, and also women who were unsuccessful. So what we know from the local elections, which just happened in May, is that only 24% of our councillors are women. And this is a figure that really isn't shifting and isn't changing. And so what we did in terms of this survey was to really try to get a better understanding as to what the issues were for women. And there's a number of particular features that relate to women that do not relate to men. One of them, across the board, you know, no matter what party you were in, was the issue of caring responsibilities and the fact that women have the majority of caring responsibilities. So they often refer to it as the triple shift of being in paid work, then doing all the unpaid care work, and then either canvassing and being out there campaigning, are then being elected as councillors. And also for women, in terms of thinking about going for election to local government, they also think about the difficulties it's going to cause them in terms of caring responsibilities. And those issues are not there for men. So right across the board, they all cited childcare as being a stumbling block. Some women talked about needing to bring their children out with them canvassing. Mm-hmm. Others spoke about needing to canvass during the daytime because their children were at school. So it was a constant issue. And it's an issue that men aren't thinking about.
No, and it would be familiar to women in other walks of life as well, just these kind of pressures. But interestingly, when you talk about the proportion of women
women elected to local authorities. 23% of councillors are women, you say, but only 29% are candidates. And that's what you're focusing in on. Get more candidates.
Absolutely. I mean, what we want is the political parties to be forced through a quota to put forward and initially we were saying 30%, but it'll be 40% now in terms of the general election. So really it should be 40% as well for the locals. We want it to mirror, the general election quota should be mirrored at local level. And we know how critical that is, because unless they're forced to do that, then they won't put the supports necessary in place. I mean, one of the other features in the research shows the importance of involvement in local networks. And for men in particular, it's about being involved in sporting networks, in the GAA, and that's where political parties go to, where women, for example, are much more likely to be involved in community organisations, but political parties don't seem to count that in terms of the experience as being important. So there are really important things here, and particularly for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, the two parties who did not meet the 30% quota in these local elections, that they need to focus on, and they need to put the supports in place.
And the candidate quotas have been effective, have they, at the Dáil level? There has been a noticeable increase in the number of women elected.
They've been extremely effective, because it was only when the quota came in for the general elections did we see that significant jump. It's still not good enough. You know, it's still, you know, we're still in low percentages. We haven't reached the 30%, but it was the biggest increase that we saw. So we know that quotas work. And we also know this from other countries around Europe, that quotas work. And quotas, at the end of the day, will be temporary, because it'll become the norm. It'll become part of what we do, and then we won't need them anymore. Now we absolutely need it for our local elections.
Orla O'Connor from the National Women's Council, thank you very much for talking to us. That survey being released today, compiled by Dr. Pauline Cullen and Claire McGing of NUI Maynooth. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
It's just 2 minutes to 9.